I was born in this little town in Oregon, Clatskanie, Oregon, population of 700 or 800 people, and I think that population has remained intact at least since I was born there. I went to the town a few years ago, and it's still a population of 720 people, and I guess it was about the size when I was born there. And when I was 2 years old, my parents moved to Yakima, Washington, where my dad was a sawfighter. He worked in a lumber mill there. And I grew up there, went to high school there, and was married there early. I was married when I was 18, and when I was 19, my wife and I and our two baby children moved to Chico, California.
Was that for the purpose of going to school?
Well, at the time, I was taking a couple of courses. I was working full-time and taking a couple of courses at a community college in Yakima. But my wife's mother had bought a house in a little town called Paradise, California. It was a little ramshackle two-bedroom house that she purchased. I think she was feeling that she might retire there at some time or another, but she couldn't live there. So we actually moved down there to because of the free rent. And the rent, I think her mortgage payment was $35 a month. And we felt we could meet that somewhere or another. Although it got difficult at times to meet that. But we were looking for a place that we could live without the outgo being greater than our income. And we were just, I suppose, too, we were looking for an adventure, something to change in our lives. We were tired of living in this little town in eastern Washington and thought we would move to California, where living was easier, so they said. And there was a state college in the area, Chico State College, which was 10 miles away from Paradise, California, where we moved to. I enrolled full-time. I was working nights in a drugstore in Chico, and I enrolled as a full-time student at Chico State College when I was 19, and it coincided with John Gardner's arrival there to teach. And as I said in the introduction, it was his second teaching job. He had taught for a year at Oberlin College, and then he'd come on to Chico State College. A creative writing course had never been taught at Chico State College, but he came in, and one of the courses he taught, he had a very heavy load at Chico, but one of the courses he taught was creative writing, and I signed up for the course. And studied with him and soaked up everything I could from him for a year. I'd never met anyone like him. I'd never met anyone like him then, and never met anyone like him since. It was a fortuitous meeting, and without question it had changed my life, even though some of the things I learned from him and did not begin to bear fruit in my own work until much later. Things got in the way of my writing, raising a family and earning a living and so forth. But many of the things I learned from him stuck with me.
Yeah. This time in your life, I mean, you've met John Gardner. You wanted to write, obviously, but did it ever occur to you that this would ultimately lead to, in effect, a full-time occupation for you?
I had always dreamed that I would be a writer, but I always wanted to be a writer. I more than anything, since I was a kid and had listened to my dad read me stories, wherever he might be reading, I'd go and sit on his bed and ask him to read to me. And he read Zane Grey Westerns, and I think those were the only books I saw in the house when I was growing up. We had a Bible, and he had some hardcover copies of Zane Grey. But he told me stories, and for some reason, I got caught up in the storytelling, and those stories seemed more real than my own life. Those worlds that the writers created. And I was interested in telling and reading stories and interested in listening to stories, and then I wanted to write some of my own. I suppose that I couldn't really I wanted to write more than anything, but I it was very hard for me to see beyond the next month and the responsibilities and awesome obligations of attending to growing children and so forth. But I never saw myself as a full time writer. I became a teacher. I simply backed into teaching. I never thought I would become a full time teacher either. I suppose I just wanted to write, and I didn't know what the results of that would be. But I wanted to write. That's all. More than anything, and where that would lead me, I didn't know. But I certainly did want to write. But I also knew I was going to be faced with, earning a living and trying to get educated, and I didn't know what I would, really didn't know what I would do with the degree once I got the degree, because I didn't want to teach. I suppose I thought it would open some doors for me in a sense that I could go out and work for the State of California Department of Employment. In fact, I was offered a job with them once. And then I wound up when I was 30 years old, working as a textbook editor in Palo Alto for a publishing company called Science Research Associates, SRA. In the meanwhile, I had published some stories and some poems, but I had not then published a book. But I had done a number of other jobs in the meanwhile. Worked as a delivery man and worked as a janitor and done this and done that. And my wife was working through many of these years as well. Looking back on it now, it was a very scattered life in many regards. We had no real fixed center, except the relationship between my wife and me was always solid then. But we moved around a lot. We were gypsies to a large extent. We were searching for something better for ourselves and for our children. Looking for a place that would be conducive to my writing and a happy place to raise children and so forth. And I must say that we looked and looked and never found this place.
And you looked?
We looked and looked and never found this place. Well, now this is different now because my life changed in many regards in the 1970s. After I began to teach, I was invited to teach a class at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and then I quit my job in publishing and began to teach. And around the same time, I began to drink too much and. Suddenly, from being truly a social drinker, I got into the alcohol, and I went off like a rocket, I guess, because I became a full-fledged alcoholic in no time at all, it seems. And a number of things happened. And my first life came to an end in 1977. I'm now in my second life. I have a different relationship with my wife, and I are no longer together. We were married for about 24 years. My children are, my son is now a graduate student at American University in Washington, D.C. My daughter is living out in Bellingham, Washington, raising a family of her own. I have good relationships with my children now. But I am in a different life, and the move to Syracuse was a good move for me, and the life since 1977, actually since I quit drinking, has been a vastly different kind of life. And the work is, and it's reflected in the work. The work is coming. It's getting larger, fuller, I think. I'm writing better, I think, than I've ever written in my life.
Let me go back a little bit. Did you, during this period when you were drinking heavily, in your 30s. You did seek out treatment.
I did. Finally, at the very end, last year of my drinking in 1977, a year after publication of, it was from about the time of Will You Please Be Quiet, Please came out, 1976. That was getting into the graver aspects of my drinking, and it was also at the tail end of my drinking. I actually quit drinking in June 2nd, 1977. So in my book, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please, was published in March of 76. From June of 76 until February or March of 77, I was hospitalized 3 times with the drinking. It was serious. I didn't think I would ever write again. I didn't think I would get off the booze. And I did, fortunately for me.
What was your behavior when you drank?
Well, I would drink, and I was just simply out of, you know. It's just I misbehaved badly. Oftentimes, I would be operating in after a heavy drinking bout, I'd be operating in a blackout, which is very common to alcoholics. You could do, you know, you could be on your feet for 8 or 10 hours. You could teach a class, or you could set a broken leg, or you could drive 300 miles and have absolutely no recollection of it whatsoever. So that was one aspect of the behavior. And I suppose I was difficult, if not impossible, to live with. I think I had essentially given up throwing in the towel. I wasn't writing, and didn't think I would write again. And the things I had hoped for myself and for my children, and this life I had imagined when I was 19 or 20 years old, that would somehow take place down the road. It became quite clear to me that it was not going to happen. I simply liked to drink, and I was. No question of what I was hooked on. I couldn't live with it and couldn't live without it, as they say.
In 1977, when you started a new life, without the booze?
Without the booze and without anything.
Without
the family, without an automobile, with a $500 loan that put me in. A rented house with 2 months of rent paid, and not knowing what was going to happen at the end of that 2 months, no job. And then it was simply a question of, but I was sober. It was simply a question of really trying to put together a life from ground zero, from a terrible shambles. It was just a terrible shambles. And then I began very earnestly to try to do something different with my life, try to make a new life.
And you were able to achieve much of that exercise, is that correct?
I was, I think by the time I got to Syracuse, I was well... well out of the time I got to Syracuse, January 1980, but in the meanwhile I had taught for a year sober at the University of Texas in El Paso. I had met the poet Tess Gallagher, and Tess and I are still living together. She's teaching at Syracuse. She's a very fine poet and short story writer. My life had begun to change very shortly after I quit drinking. I received a Guggenheim Fellowship in 78. That certainly helped.
Didn't you receive, wasn't there another award that you received recently that
Well, that's the Mildred and Harold Strauss Living Award, and I received that this spring, and it's something that's administered by the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and there were two recipients this year, Cynthia Ozick and myself. And that is a living, a tax-free living award. And the only stipulation of the award was that I'd not have any regular employment, such as teaching, anything, giving a paycheck from some other source. Anything I earn from my writing is absolutely fine. But they hope and expect I will devote my full energies to my writing.
How long does this?
It's a 5-year fellowship, and it's renewable. The closest thing to it would be the MacArthur Foundation fellowships that I've given in areas from physics and art and literature. In one regard, might even be better than a MacArthur Foundation fellowship, in that after 5 years, it is renewable. But whether it's renewed, in my case, whether it's renewed or not, frankly, doesn't matter to me, no. In one large sense, I feel like if I were on the committee who administers these things, probably I would vote to give it to another writer after my 5-year tenure with it, to give it to let someone else have a chance at it. I feel so.
You know, that's like getting a paycheck, right?
Right, it is. It's absolutely marvelous, and it's just something that. Beyond my wildest imaginings, when I got the letter from Arthur Schlesinger in February and read the contents of the letter, my life was, I was on leave of absence from Syracuse that spring, living in Port Angeles, Washington, which is Tess Gallagher's hometown. My life was changed and dramatically and forever the day I read the letter. I mean, I knew that my life would never be the same again.
What is the size of this?
It's $35,000 a year, tax-free.
Tax-free? Right. Do they pay you in installments?
Monthly installments.
Monthly installments?
Yes.
So that enabled you to resign?
I called up my chairman that day and said, I won't be coming back at the end of the semester. And they were immensely happy for me, and of course, they were sorry to lose me, but they were immensely pleased for me, I must say.
Where are you living now?
We're living in Syracuse now because Tess is still teaching there. At the end of this year, I don't know if she will keep a permanent half-time position there, and we will divide our time between Syracuse and Washington State, Port Angeles, Washington. She built a house out there last summer, small house. And that's where we lived this spring and this last summer.
Of course, you could live anywhere you want.
Could live anywhere we wanted, yes. It's possible that we will. We visited Switzerland last year. Tess was invited to the University of Zurich for a couple of weeks, and we were over there, and we liked it very much over there. But we could live anywhere we wanted. But I happen to like Syracuse. I have friends there for the first time. I feel like that I have a home. I have friends and a community in Syracuse that I haven't had for many, many years.
We're not going to have too much more time, so I want to pursue some of the themes in your writing and your approach. It's understandable, based on your background, that drinking is a real problem of many of the characters in your short stories. Are you going to continue to draw on this theme? It's also true that as you read Cathedral and the other books, many of the lives of the characters are rather depressing. And I don't know to what degree the lives of the people that you write about mirrors your own life, but I have a feeling much of it does. Is that correct?
Well, of course, stories don't just come out of thin air, and certainly the fiction that I find myself most interested in seem to have very definite lines of reference into a real world. whether it's Tolstoy or Ernest Hemingway or Flannery O'Connor or Frank O'Connor, name any number of good writers. But I think you're asking me partly in which direction my fiction may be going from now on as well. And I feel like some of the stories in here, especially some of the more recent stories that are in Cathedral, are going in another direction other than some of these stories that you remarked on that have to do with alcohol and the fact that some of the people, some of the characters are really whipped out. And I don't know if I have to feel it. These stories are reflecting, some of these newer stories in the book are reflecting changes in my own life. Perhaps I'm, in my middle years here, I'm becoming more optimistic. I don't know. I think I am. And that has been reflected in the work, I think, in some of these stories. Like this story, Fever, for instance, which is the last story that I wrote that went into the book, and it's also, I think, the longest story. And I think that story ends on a ray of hope, if you will. It's perhaps more positive than some of the other stories. And also the long story, A Small Good Thing, is different in conception and different in execution than many of the earlier stories, shorter stories. It's a much fuller story, and if you look at that, the last pages, I think it's opening up into something entirely different than I've ever done before, and the title story, Cathedral, as well. In a sense, I feel positively disloyal to the earlier books, because I like this book so much. I think it's the best book I've done, and very happy with it.
Your writing style, you have a marvelous writing style, which is very lean, very spare, very sparse, very easy to read. You communicate extremely easily. I just wonder if, I'm just taking a guess, I don't know if this comes naturally to you, this is something that you learned over many years, something that John Gardner helped you to learn, but it would seem to me that if I were to write, and I try, not very successfully, but if I were to write, I would write, and then I would go back over it and start eliminating words.
I do that. I love to do that, yes. I'd rather rewrite a story than write the story. I love to rewrite. I love to take a piece of prose that I've written and turn it around and put it to the typewriter again and take things out. I also put some things back in, other things. The process of rewriting for me is there's a lot of taking out and some putting in. Most of my stories, though, I've noticed I write the stories very quickly. I don't think I've ever spent longer than 2 days actually writing the first draft of a story. I like to take a very long stretch. I mean, I just have a day ahead of me with no obligations whatsoever. And just write the story as fast as I'm able to write it. And I might write 40 pages in one sitting, as it were. But when the story is finally finished, after numerous revisions, it is usually about half that. The story is 20 pages when I write it, it will usually come out to be 10 pages when it's finished. And that seems to be pretty accurate. I don't think I've ever written a story that was 20 pages long, and then when I finished it, it was 60 pages long.
Of course, you have written essays, poems, short stories. When can we expect something longer? When can we expect a long work of fiction from you?
A novel. I'm going to write a novel next year. It's not because there's any pressure on me to write a novel. That happened after the publication of Will You Please Be Quiet, Please. People asked me and suggested in no uncertain terms of how I should write a novel. I didn't feel like I wanted to write a novel, and I didn't feel like I was still more interested in short stories. Now, I want to write the novel, and I think that a writer shouldn't necessarily go around looking for a subject for a novel. I think that that idea for the novel should come to him or her. That idea has now, to a degree, taken hold of me, and it's something that I want to do now. And it just so happens that everything in my life is in place now to do that longer work. And so I'm terribly pleased that that's the case.
You said the theme has come to you?
Well, I don't know. I never think in terms of themes, but the conception and the idea of the novel has come to me now. And it just simply was not there before, but it's come to me now at the right time in my life, where I can see this span of time ahead of me, and it just is coincidental with the idea of this longer work of fiction that I want to undertake. So all of these things are conjoining to make it for a very happy set of circumstances.
When you were teaching creative writing at Syracuse, who were the writers you urged your students to read?
I had them read Frank O'Connor. I had them read some Franz Kafka. I had them reading Flannery O'Connor. I had them reading John Gardner. I had them reading Ann Beatty. I had them reading Chekhov, for sure. I had them reading selected stories of Tolstoy. I had them reading John Gardner. John Cheever, in addition to John Gardner. I had them read a book of short stories by Nabokov, who was a very good short story writer. I had them reading Hemingway. I had them reading an author named Max Schott. I had them reading Joy Williams. I had them reading a number of people.
Have you, over the years, kept up a relationship with John Gardner?
For many years after our association at Chico State College, we were out of touch. He was going on about his life, and with his life, and I was going on with mine. And we didn't get in touch until about 3 years ago, when Harold Brodkey brought us together for a dinner at Ithaca, New York. And John was teaching then and living in Binghamton, New York. And he and his wife, Liz Rosenberg, came for dinner with Harold and Ellen Schwamm and Tess Gallagher and myself. That was the first time I had seen John in about 18 years, and it was wonderful to see him again. And then we began a friendship. Then that lasted from then until the time he died. Tess and I went down to visit and spend the night and had dinners, and so forth.
And Gardner also had a drinking problem at one time, didn't he?
That I don't know. I can't. I know that he drank, but now how much he drank, I can't say. I don't think it was ever so serious that he was incapacitated with it. I can't speak to that because I really don't know.
Well, Raymond Carver, you're still a young man, and you say you have your life back on track. You have this tremendous award that's going to enable you to focus on your writing. I know that you're going to be a voice that will influence our lives for a long time in the future.
Thank you very much. Thank you.